All right, y'all, welcome to the show. What do I got for you today? So, Ben Shapiro commented on the Richard Dawkins clip, which went viral, where he described how he considers himself a cultural Christian. And of course, Ben can't help himself but take a bunch of shots at atheism. So we'll dive into that. I got a lot to say about that one. We have Fox Business hosts absolutely melting down over a $20 minimum wage for fast food workers in California. That's really something to behold. And then later on, the Libs of TikTok creator struggles to define wokeness, which is something that we've seen a number of times now, where people who sort of make their whole politics based around wokeness being bad struggle to even give a basic definition of what they mean by that. And then later on, we have a corporate profits bonanza, a great article from Judd Legum, where he lays out how the majority of the inflation that we've seen is a direct result simply of corporate greed. It's got nothing to do with big spending. At this point, it's much less about the supply chain. It is simply corporations being like, hey, we can get away with price gouging people, so let's go ahead and price gouge people. And then also we have Stephen A. Smith, my favorite enlightened centrist on the planet, decides to take some shots at Hillary Clinton. And I must say, it is a glorious clip if I've ever seen one. So we'll talk about all that and more. Everybody do me a big favor. Subscribe to the channel. Hook a brother up. If you're not subbed, I don't know what the hell you're doing with your life. Trying to get to 10 million subsies. Need your sub. Hook me up. And let's go ahead and jump into it. So as I pointed out, Ben Shapiro commented on Richard Dawkins calling himself a cultural Christian. And he does this long segment where he basically weaves this giant argument about how you can't base a society around non-belief. And so we're going to have some fun. We're going to watch this and we're going to break it down. I have him on 1.25 time speed, but I reserve the right to take him off of that because with Ben Shapiro, 1.25 is like double speed. So we'll see how I feel. Let's watch.
Dawkins has for a very long time been the most famous atheist on planet Earth. Obviously, he's written extensively about why Christianity and Judaism and Islam and all religions are wrong. He's written about the so-called God delusion, this idea that a belief in a higher power is in fact a delusion, but he has simultaneously called himself a cultural Christian. So here he was on LBC talking about his views of cultural Christianity.
Well, I must say I was slightly horrified to hear that Ramadan is being promoted instead. I do think that we are culturally a Christian country. I call myself a cultural Christian. I'm not a believer. But there's a distinction between being a believing Christian and being a cultural Christian. And so, you know, I love hymns and Christmas carols, and I sort of feel at home in the Christian ethos. I feel that we are a Christian country in that sense. It's true that statistically the number of people who actually believe in Christianity is going down, and I'm happy with that. But I would not be happy if, for example, we lost all our cathedrals and our beautiful parish churches. So I count myself a cultural Christian. I think it would matter. If we substituted any alternative religion, that would be truly dreadful.
Okay, but we have substituted an alternative religion, and that religion is paganism, because the reality is that when you cut off a civilization from its Judeo-Christian roots, what you end up with is a paganistic replacement for that religion.
All right, that's just made up. That's just made up. There is no official pagan replacement for a Judeo-Christian system. First of all, a lot of the countries that these guys consider Judeo-Christian countries are actually secular. So let's get that out of the way first, right? That a lot of these countries, which are considered Christian because the majority of the population is Christian, they're not actually definitionally Christian, they're more secular. But the idea that if you don't, what, have a society based on Christianity, that it's based on paganism? No. It could just be totally agnostic on the question of theism or deism. So it's agnostic on any semblance of religion, and also agnostic on the idea of, like, is there a God? Like, the government doesn't have to comment on whether or not they think there's a God, right? So he just makes stuff up, but he says it confidently. So I think some people hear it and they're like, that must be true. He said it confidently. But stop and think about it. If we don't have a society based on Christianity or Judeo-Christian values, that goofy phrase they like to use, why does it necessarily follow that it's going to be based on paganism? What are you talking about?
It devolves into paganism pretty quickly because all of the central premises of humanism, things like reliance on human reason, make an argument for human reason as an independent force. You cannot, from an evolutionarily biological perspective, you can't. You can.
Now who's like the philosopher king debate bro in college class. Make an argument for human reason. You can't do that. What?
That human beings are capable of using their brains in order to adapt to their environment. You cannot say that human beings are capable of searching for truth. There is no such thing as truth in evolutionary biology. There's just what's effective and what's not effective. Everything is utilitarian in nature.
Now who's the postmodernist? What even is, like, objective truth, bro? This is an argument that the right makes against the left all the time. It's Jordan Peterson's whole shtick. The left believes that there's no such thing fundamentally as objective truth, and that's a war on reality. That was a terrible Jordan Peterson impression. It's early. Give me a break on that. But, like, what is he talking about?
Of using their brains in order to adapt to their environment. You cannot say that human beings are capable of searching for truth. There is no such thing as truth in evolutionary biology. There's just what's effective and what's not effective. Everything is utilitarian in nature.
Yeah, but that can be true, and it also can be true that you look for the truth to determine the mechanisms of how that functions, right? What's he doing? What's he doing? All of a sudden, he sounds like a postmodernist trying to make the argument you can't base a system on not being religious.
Can't make the case for higher concepts like justice or freedom if you are operating from a non-God-based universe.
Of course you can. You're saying there can't be a conception from an atheist of, like, justice? Why would you make such a ridiculous claim? I'd venture to guess that the majority of people who would describe themselves as secular, atheist, or agnostic, or just not religious, anti-theist, they would tell you, yes, I have a conception of what is justice, what is right, what is wrong. Like, he's got a real, like, he's beaten up on a straw atheist in his mind. The idea of an atheist who's, like, totally vapid and vacuous and rejects the notion of concepts of justice and right and wrong. And that's just, like, you're just straw-manning atheists. The majority of atheists would say, yeah, of course I have a concept of what constitutes justice and injustice, etc.
You might be able to live that way individually. You can be like Richard Dawkins and be an atheist and be a cultural Christian. But you cannot separate the church building that he is praising there off from what goes on inside the church.
Yes, you can. Like, his point is, I like the Christmas carols. I like the hymns. So, like, I like the music. And effectively, you know, that's why I call myself a cultural Christian. I actually agree with Ben. It's annoying he calls himself a cultural Christian in the sense that, like, you spent your whole life beating up on religion. You're the world's number one atheist. And now it's just like you throw your hat in the ring with, like, well, I'm going to be tribalistic to some extent. I'm going to throw my lot in with this religious group. And it's like, okay, that's pretty Weasley. But the idea that you can't like certain things about the culture while not believing in it, of course that could be the case. Guys, what is Christmas nowadays anyway? Over 90% of the United States celebrates Christmas. Only 72% of the country is Christian. So you have some people who are not Christian who celebrate Christmas. Why? It's become its own thing. I hate to say it, but it's about materialism. It's about consumerism. It's about a fat guy in a red suit with a big beard who we pretend comes down the chimney, right? That is mixed with some pagan type ritualistic stuff. Easter. Okay, the resurrection of Christ, but also, there's a frickin' bunny and colorful eggs and candy. Like, of course you could separate out. Like, I don't believe in the literal word. I don't believe in the nonsense stories. I don't even believe that this gets at the core of some fundamental human truth. But I like it when we do the Easter bunny stuff. I like it when we do the Santa Claus stuff. Of course you could do it.
Is an outward manifestation of the soul that is the church. The same thing is true of our civilization. Our civilization is built in a particular way, on particular frameworks and foundations. And when you destroy those foundations and frameworks, what you end up with is secularist pursuit of values that ends up undermining itself and eating itself. You end up with postmodernism.
He was the one who was just making a postmodernist argument. He was the one who just made a postmodernist argument. Talk about, well, when it comes to evolutionary biology, there is no truth. Yes, there is. It also, you know, the process itself is, it like determines survival of the fittest and things of that nature, right? So I understand what his argument was, but there's also, you're trying to discover objective truth when you look at that stuff. So you were the one making the postmodernist argument 2.5 seconds ago.
The reason that postmodernism is a natural outgrowth is because it is a natural decay. You go from a thriving civilization, an enlightenment civilization that was in fact rooted in Judeo-Christian values. This is why, for example, when it comes to capitalism, Adam Smith wrote Theory of Moral Sentiments before he wrote Wealth of Nations. Theory of Moral Sentiments is an entire book about virtue and necessity thereof. And then he wrote Wealth of Nations, which was predicated on the idea that when you have a civilization that does in fact promote virtue, capitalism can thrive.
So the implication here is capitalism is the natural outgrowth of having virtues as the bedrock of your society. Like, it is the moral system that grows out of having these proper Judeo-Christian values, which is kind of hilarious, because anybody who reads the Bible, anybody who reads the New Testament and comes out with the idea thinking that Jesus is a capitalist needs their head examined. The guy is a communist before communism was a thing. There are so many contradictory things in the Bible, but there are also things that are not at all contradictory. In some areas, it is remarkably consistent. All throughout the New Testament, it's treat the sojourners like they're your family members, like they're your friends. That's literally the word they use for immigrants. So be super kind to immigrants. Is that what Ben Shapiro likes to do? Is that what the right likes to do nowadays? How often does Jesus have to invoke this notion that the rich can't get into heaven? It's only the poor and the downtrodden and the left behind. Those are the ones who can get into heaven. This guy was a hippie commie before hippies or communism was a thing. The idea that he would, what, be okay with people going bankrupt over medical bills? Like, what are we talking about here? Jeez, this is such a confused rant on his part. He's trying to make the argument you can't have a moral society without a religious core of it. But obviously the huge gaping hole in his argument is that in the past we've had hyper-religious societies, and they were actually some of the most immoral societies. Like, the Crusades was based on a hyper-religiosity, right? Like, the heart of Christendom, I think is how they say, Christendom, however you say it. Like, that's when you get the Crusades. People who are drunk on their religion and so sure that they're right, and so sure they want to spread their values by a sword. So, and also, you know, hyper-religious societies. Israel. An ethnostate and a theocracy, hyper-religious society. Islamic theocracies, those are very religious. I don't like any theocracies. The idea that a Judeo-Christian framework leads to good outcomes. No, what happens is these idiots like to pretend like all of the positive things we got from the Enlightenment, they just attribute it to the Judeo-Christian framework. And it's like, that's 100% wrong. You had secular forces had to fight back the draconian religious forces to get us any semblance of what we would call positive today, like egalitarianism, for example, universalism. Like, it's just, it's so confused. He thinks the core of everything that's good is a Judeo-Christian framework for our society, when that shit is much more likely to get you burning witches at the stake, oppressing gay people and all sorts of minorities, including religious and ethnic minorities. Like, that's what that sort of system gets you. It's not, you know, human rights and justice and egalitarianism. That's all an outgrowth of secularism and the Enlightenment.
Same thing is true of things like free speech. These all exist on deeper foundations. Those deep.
Yeah. Religion, well known for being a friend of free speech. All the religions were a massive enemy of free speech. The church tried to censor people who would, try to take on their truths, what they determined as truth, which of course wasn't at all true. Blasphemy, right? Like, that was a big thing. Oh, Jesus, he's so wrong on every level.
Foundations are religious in nature. Trying to separate those off, pretending that they are the natural state of the world, is historically ignorant. History is, in fact, contingent. The Enlightenment rests on Christian bases.
Nonsense. The Enlightenment had to butt up against Christianity and fight all religious dogmas.
Pretending that it does not means that you end up severing the two, and an Enlightenment severed from its Christian bases ends in terror.
Whereas, you know, a religious-based society never becomes a terror. Please.
Actually ends in gulags and death camps. The cost of—
Oh my God. Oh, and we cut to an ad. This is so classic Ben Shapiro, making horrible, shitty arguments and cutting to an ad. Let's jump ahead and not listen to the ad. Birch Goldgreen, he's hawking some gold scam now. That's great. Tell me more about your religiosity, Ben, as you hype your gold scam.
98, that's Ben, to 98. This is the point that Nietzsche was making near the end of the 19th century. He was making the case that when you kill God, you don't, in fact, end up with a higher secular humanism. You end up with a pagan pursuit of power. You end up with the pursuit of the Ubermensch, because you live in a cold, meaningless universe in which will is the only thing that matters. Power is the only thing that matters.
So, in other words, he is insisting that if you have a society that's non-religious, it necessarily ends in people being more ruthless and vicious and power hungry. Well, Ben, I got bad news for you. The ruthless, vicious, power hungry thing, that's just like a part of human nature. So are good things like empathy and community and stuff like that, love. But like, that's just part of human nature. The idea that the more secular a society is, the more likely you get to that outcome, that's just fundamentally not true. There's been deeply religious wars. There's been wars that have nothing to do with religion at all and are more about natural resources, for example. There's been murderous dictators who are religious and aren't religious. There's been extremists of all kinds. The idea that a Judeo-Christian framework sort of protects you from bad excesses is silly. It's a child's reading of history.
This is why the arguments that are currently made about how, for example, freedom of speech is just a guise for power. This is the argument the left makes against freedom of speech. Property rights.
Okay, let's be clear. Most leftists do not oppose freedom of speech. Like, he's just assuming that everybody on the left is like anti-free speech and they make some power argument to justify censorship or whatever. You just fired Candace Owens because she said stuff about Israel you didn't like. So spare me your sanctimonious holier than thou. We love free speech. You guys hate free speech nonsense. You and Dave Rubin were just jerking each other off about how the Daily Wire letting somebody go who has bad opinions is okay because we're a publisher. We're not a platform. So we're allowed to be censorious and it's not actually censorious.
Are not about the natural outgrowth of human beings want to create and to cultivate. They are in fact an imposition by a powerful cadre of people who are attempting to victimize you. They are bad. They're a tool of the patriarchy. Those ideas are natural outgrowths of severing natural law. That's a natural outgrowth of suggesting that the universe is in fact not ruled by a creator who created a human nature and that human nature has natural consequences like property rights or should have those natural consequences. That the freedom of the mind that is guaranteed by Genesis 1:27, where it says we're all made in the image of God, meaning that we are creative and capable of will. And when you cut that off, you end up with everything is just power dynamics and power relations. As a civilization, you cut yourself off from your roots, and what you end up with is Scotland passing laws suggesting that you cannot speak freely on matters of whether a man is a woman or not.
And religious societies pass laws about how blasphemy is wrong, apostasy is wrong. You know, you're not allowed to question the dogmas of the church or Jesus' resurrection back in the day. This is just so dumb. Basically, the argument is this. Bad things come out of societies that are non-religious. Good things come out of societies that are Judeo-Christian based. That's an idea that nobody should even take remotely seriously. You can debunk it instantly. Why would you make such a bad argument?
And whoever is in power gets to cudgel the other side.
Because they don't do that. If somebody's Jewish or Christian and conservative, they never do that. They never bash the other side.
Consequence. So people have asked me many times, can there be a moral atheist? Sure, there can be a moral atheist. Can there be a system built on atheism that is moral? No.
Come on, bro. Come on. Okay. The societies in the world today that self-report the highest quality of life and the most happiness. Ready for this? They're in the Scandinavian region, and they are some of the most non-religious areas in the world. The idea that you need religion to create a moral society is laughable. Religion can be used for good. Religion can also be used for horrible things. So, again, I reiterate, how can you make such a bad argument? I like how he thinks he's being kind by conceding. You can have a moral individual atheist, yes, but you cannot base a society on it and have it be a good society. I mean, there are plenty of atheists, agnostics, secularists, societies that are very far in that direction on the spectrum that are phenomenally successful, as opposed to other countries which are super religious, which are not. So, just so bad.
There cannot be a civilizational system built on atheism. This is why when Richard Dawkins says he's a cultural Christian, the question that we should all be asking ourselves is twofold. One, is he right that our civilization rests on Christian foundations? And the answer is yes, of course he is right about that.
No. No. Because what he's doing is he's giving Christianity the credit for all of the progress made by secularism and the Enlightenment. And that I 100% reject. As the world's leading atheist, what Richard Dawkins should be doing is not calling himself a cultural Christian. throwing in his lot with this other religious tribe, which has gotten so many things wrong over the years. What he should be doing is making a proactive case for secularism and universalism, for a progressive, humanistic worldview. That's what you should do. It's not like your only options are Christian culture or Islamic culture, or Christian culture, Jewish culture, and Islamic culture. It is on the menu to have a secular humanist culture. It is on the menu to have a universalist culture. And they act like that's not the case, and they're horribly incorrect. This is a false dichotomy they're presenting you.
The second question we should ask is, then why are we destroying those Christian foundations? If the church building exists, but there's nobody inside, how long do you expect the civilization to thrive?
Very long time, actually. In fact, I think the more we are held back by religious dogmatism, the worse we are. That's not to say that religion can't, in some instances, for some people, do good. Of course it can. But it's also historically been used for so much bad, and he just overlooks that and acts like it doesn't exist. And again, gives credit to Christianity for things that the Enlightenment and secularism brought us.
If the civilization built on the Bible discards the Bible, how long do you expect that civilization to continue along the lines it has previously continued? And the argument by Dawkins and other atheists presumably will be, yes, but all that's untrue. Those would be necessary myths, but they're necessary myths, but they're myths. And so truth matters more. So first of all, I would ask, how are you defining truth? Because according to, again, folks like Richard Dawkins, and again, I like a lot of Richard Dawkins' work. It's really interesting. But according to folks like Richard Dawkins, when he says, we can't believe the Bible because it's not true, my question is, what in evolutionary biology suggests that truth is of any paramount value? If, in fact, he's a specialist in adaptation and the necessity of adaptation, then he should be a believer in the Bible simply on the adaptability basis of it.
See, so now, again, he was just slamming postmodernism a couple minutes ago. Now, again, he's making the postmodernist argument. What even is truth, bro? What even is truth?
He should be a Christian because it is useful to be a Christian.
Oh. Oh. The idea that you need Christianity to make society function smoothly. Think about how absurd that is. And this is what he's pushing.
Because that's what evolution says. Evolution is all about utility. Evolution is not about fundamental truth. But he says you have to discard the Bible because it is, quote unquote, not fundamentally true, because you can't prove the miracles. You can't prove God. Okay, but in what world, in your world, why does truth with a capital T matter?
Because he's not a postmodernist like you.
You live in evolutionary meme land, right? The basic idea that the genes are self-replicating and seek to survive. And all of that is predicated on a notion of adaptability and utility. It is not predicated on a notion of truth. So you can't rely upon my religious notions of truth in order to knock out the Bible. Number two, why exactly shouldn't it be true? If it is proved that Western civilization is in fact the highest form of civilization that man has experienced, and it is rooted in Christian and Judaic values, there are two possibilities. One, it's a necessary myth, a Platonic necessary myth. And two, is maybe there is truth to it.
What a massive overreach. This is where people like Richard Dawkins would have a field day and just point to like the thousands of contradictions and dumb statements and things that make no sense and things that didn't happen and are impossible, that you point all that stuff out in the Christian tradition, in the Bible, etc. Like, look at this face. Look at his face here. So smug and so wrong. Again, the assumption here is you need Christianity or a Judeo-Christian framework to make a society function well. And that's just not true. It's just not. In fact, I think more often than not, religiosity as the basis of a society hurts. It doesn't help. It leads to more tribalism. It leads to more injustice. It leads to more arbitrary rules, censorship, authoritarianism. And so, like, the whole framework of what he's saying here is wrong. But by the way, that's also, you know, why I sort of disagreed with Dawkins, too, is that I'm like, why are you calling yourself a cultural Christian? It's giving Christianity too much credit to sort of assume that, well, obviously positive things came out of that. Obviously, that's the basis of our society, and I like that it led to these positive outcomes. No longer should anybody give credit to Christianity or Judaism or the Judeo-Christian framework for advancements that came about as a direct result of the Enlightenment and secularism and humanism and universalism. So, I don't know. We'll finish this up, but I think our points are clear at this point.
And maybe it seems that while people like Richard Dawkins can individually reject the premises of the Bible while accepting the conclusions, maybe it turns out that the vast majority of the population cannot and should not. Maybe it turns out that we need more Christians going to church and we need more Jews going to synagogue. Maybe that's actually really important to civilization. Otherwise, you end up in the muck that we currently find ourselves. What I would say to Richard Dawkins is, if you like the Christmas carols, someone needs to believe in Christ to sing them. If you like the churches, somebody has to go to church to actually maintain the church. If you like the civilization in which you live, somebody's got to maintain those biblical roots. Somebody's got to go to the garden and cultivate and guard it. It's pretty important. Are you tired of...
Okay, hilarious. Right after his postmodernist rant, at the end of it, facts is on the screen. You were just the one arguing that facts don't really matter. And maybe the Bible is true. God. I think I've said all I need to say. This is just sad at this point. So, Fox Business Network, which basically exists to tell multimillionaires and billionaires and corporations what they want to hear, they did a segment here talking about this new law, which just went into effect in California. And they are outraged at the notion that fast food workers in California are now going to make $20 an hour. They think this is injustice. They think this is bizarre and unacceptable. So let's listen to some of what they have to say. Then there's a lot to point out.
Starting today, fast food workers in California will be paid at least $20 an hour. Now, some restaurants having to hike prices and cut staff. $20 an hour for fast...
More on that in a minute. The hike prices and cut staff thing. Not totally accurate.
Restaurant workers, is that sustainable, Leo?
Absolutely not, and I'll tell you why. You know, my first job was at McDonald's. A long time ago, I made $1.45. Okay, that tells you how old I am. But here's the problem. The Newsom administration is trying to make minimum wage job career jobs. Minimum wage jobs are transitional jobs.
Okay, that's just not true. There's plenty of people. In fact, if I remember correctly, I used to know the exact statistic, but I think it's a majority of minimum wage workers. It's not like they're a teenager and it's the summer and they need some gas money or whatever. No. For a very, very large number of them, it's their job. It's their job. Now, you might turn around and say, well, they should get their shit together and climb up the ladder. How do you know they're not trying to climb up the ladder? And also, don't we also need people to do those jobs? So if you need people to do those jobs, you can't just say, oh, get a job higher up the ladder. Well, if everybody got a job higher up the ladder, nobody would be there to even do those jobs. Then you want people back in those jobs. But what you want is people back in those jobs making less than a living wage. Now, by the way, a living wage in the state of California is about $27 an hour. So this $20 an hour, it's way better than what we had before, but it's still not even a living wage. And they're outraged that workers will make a little more money to be a little more comfortable. Look, all of their arguments are just going to rest on premises that are fundamentally untrue. The idea that all minimum wage jobs are just for college kids who are trying to make some money during the summer or whatever, it's just not true. There are plenty of people who do these jobs, and it's their job. And do they, if you work full time, is it their contention that you don't deserve enough money to survive? Because look, I was led to believe, and this is what the conservatives tell me all the time, the harder you work, the further you go. That's how it should be. If you're working full time, you're contributing to society and you deserve to be rewarded for that and paid for that. It's the people who are not working who we think are lazy and should get their shit together. Well, here somebody is working full time and they're saying, fuck off, work for less than what you can live on. Jeez, just so, it's so gross. It's so gross.
Administration is trying to make minimum wage job career jobs. Minimum wage jobs are transitional jobs. Who's going to pay for that $20 per hour? The consumer. It's a tax. And you know what's going to happen? Small businesses are going to be driven out of California. This minimum wage law is insulting to the average mom and pop store because...
Okay. Now let me give you a fact in this conversation, which they're leaving out. They did, in California, they did something called sectoral bargaining, which basically means that you're unionized across an entire industry. So in this instance, it's sectoral bargaining for fast food workers. So basically all the workers who work in the fast food industry in California, they all get together, they are unionized, and they negotiate with management for a wage to set across all of the different individual fast food restaurants. That's why it's sectoral bargaining, right? And so what they came to is they agreed to $20 an hour. So in this instance, this just applies to the fast food workers. So to invoke mom and pop, oh my God, the mom and pop shops are really going to get hurt by this. Well, they're just not. That's not true. Now, does that mean that workers who work at a mom and pop shop shouldn't make a living wage? I don't think so. But by the way, there is a really easy solution to that. The government could easily say, hey, the minimum wage is now a living wage, and we're also going to have a subsidy program where if an individual small business, a mom and pop shop, can't afford to pay the workers that they have that living wage, they can apply and get subsidized to make up the difference in the wage. So, for example, perhaps one of the stores pays their workers $15 an hour, and then the government steps in with a subsidy program and pays the extra $5 an hour for that person's wages. So in other words, there are intelligent, rational solutions outside of shut the fuck up and work for poverty wages. Shut up and work for less than you can survive on. But interestingly, these Fox hosts always default to shut up and work for less than you can survive on.
Cannot afford it, Stu. And I'll tell you right now, it is, again, trying to deprioritize career opportunities.
So helping workers is actually hurting workers. Got it.
You can make a career off a minimum wage job. You cannot. It is wrong.
Okay, well, what about people who they try and that's the only job they were able to get? And they got to pay the bills, right? Are you saying, yes, work full time and don't make enough money to survive? That is phenomenally entitled, especially in a situation where the CEOs and the owners of these companies are making millions and millions and millions. Don't tell me, hey, we can't afford to make sure our workers survive. Well, then maybe you shouldn't be in business, right? Maybe you shouldn't be in business in that scenario. And like I said, there's other solutions too, where you could have a subsidy program to make up the difference for some instances. But these are the fast food companies. They don't need no fucking subsidy. They can handle it.
It's going to be popular with those people who suddenly earn $20 an hour. It would be politically popular. Look, California's got the highest poverty rate in the nation. I would imagine that a measure like this, you bump everybody up to $20 an hour, that would be popular. That's a vote winner, isn't it?
Yeah, let me tell you, here's the elephant in the room. Guess who's happy? The union. This is what's going to happen. These employees at these restaurants are going to be unionized. Guess what's going to happen? They're going to contribute money to the union. Guess who's going to get the money? The Democrats. This is the long-run plan of trying to put more money in the Democratic Party's pocket. It is basically a failed policy. And like I said again, California has not hit rock bottom yet, Stu. We got a long way to go, and you better make some room for me in New Jersey.
So in other words, doing things that are good for workers, doing things that are good for your constituents, doing things that are popular, as Stuart Varney admitted, this is going to be popular. They're saying it's corrupt to do things that are good for workers or unions or things that are popular. We've heard them explicitly make this argument in the past. Oh, you're buying votes by raising the minimum wage. In this case, it's really sectoral bargaining, and they set the wage at 20 in the fast food industry. But you get the point. They're saying it's unfair that you're trying to pay workers more. It's unfair because they're going to like you and then they're going to vote for you. Okay, that's what we call democracy. That's what we call doing the will of the people. And yeah, is it going to be liked? Yes, but good. I love it when politicians do things that the American people want. And what these guys are doing is they're showing their hand here. They don't like it when politicians do what workers want, what the American people want, what would be popular. They don't want that. They want what's good for the billionaires and the multinational corporations. All right, so now let me get to the more important fact here. This is really something. So the End Wokeness account, I love this, tweeted the following. California hiked the minimum wage to $20 per hour for fast food workers this week. You'll never guess what happened next. Now, by the way, the facts there are a little wrong. It was sectoral bargaining, and they negotiated for the $20 wage, which was set across the fast food industry. It's not the same as saying it's a $20 an hour minimum wage. It's not necessarily true. But that's a minor point I'm nitpicking here. Back to the tweet. California hiked the minimum wage $20 per hour for fast food workers this week. You'll never guess what happened next. So as you can see here, March 29th price, a double-double, was $5.65. Now it's $5.90. You have a cheeseburger was $3.95. Now it's $4.10. A hamburger was $3.50. Now it's $3.60. French fries were $2.30. Apparently, they're still $2.30. Shakes were $2.95. Now shakes are $3. Homie's bringing this up as if to make the point.
Well, obviously,
We should pay those fast food workers starvation wages, please. Go back to paying them less, yes. That's the implication of this. Oh my God, one of these things costs like a dime more. What are we doing here? Society's falling apart. This is terrible. I like what this person said. A 23% wage increase led to a 4% price increase. That's called winning at policymaking. Guys, we've seen this before. Somebody did this study. I remember covering this on the show like a decade ago. Somebody did a study on if you raise the minimum wage for, I believe it was Walmart workers at the time, to $15 an hour, and they crunched the numbers and said how much the price of a certain good would go up, and it was like 4 cents more. It's like, so hold on. Pay the workers a living wage, and you only have to pay 4 cents more for some shit? Like, I'm not kidding. Literally, everybody I know would be like, oh, of course. That's a no-brainer. Help the workers out. If somebody works full-time, they should make enough money to survive. That's the least controversial perspective I've ever put out there on this show. That's something where you bring it up to people. Everybody's like, of course. But then when they're actually moving towards that here, you got these, the End Wokeness account, which again, it goes to show you, what does this have to do with wokeness? So the $20 minimum wage is woke? Paying workers who work full-time more money is woke? It's not just about wokeness. In other words, it's now tied into just right-wing beliefs. And apparently, a classic right-wing belief is like, just fuck the workers. What happened? I thought you guys, oh, we're the blue-collar party now, bro. We're looking out for workers, bro. Don't raise their wage! Don't raise their wages! You might have to pay 10 cents more for something at a burger place. How sad is this? Everybody needs to understand. This is what these people believe. This is what these people support. This is it. They actually have the belief, if you work full time, you shouldn't make enough money to survive. Suffer. Sit there and suffer. Serve me and suffer. Hell no, man. Hell no. Not only do I like sectoral bargaining in this instance, I think we should have it in every industry all across the country. And by the way, in that scenario, you wouldn't even need an official minimum wage. There's a lot of Scandinavian countries. Some of them they don't have an official minimum wage, but they have almost like universal unionization. And so wages are set in each industry. And you don't even need a minimum wage because the minimum that anybody is paid is even above what a minimum wage would be. Right? And guess what? Those countries aren't collapsing. Those economies aren't in free fall. In fact, it's makes those countries strong. It makes them happier, makes their quality of life better. Turns out paying people a decent amount, paying them enough to survive as they work full time, turns out that creates a healthier and happier society. And again, God forbid in this scenario, 23% wage increase for a 4% price increase. Like, sign me up all day long. Apparently, the only people who disagree are the End Wokeness types and the freaks on Fox Business Network, whose entire existence is to suck off billionaires, multimillionaires, and multinational corporations. All right, so this is fun right here. The Libs of TikTok lady, her name is Chaya Rychik. She's made quite a name for herself with her little Libs of TikTok account. Now, I have no idea why she was brought in to speak at some college, some event. I just, like, really? This is what we're doing now? What, is she considered a public intellectual or something like that? Have you heard her in any interviews? Does she seem like an intellectual to you? Well, anyway, so she went and gave some sort of speech. And I don't know, she apparently naively expected that this room of college students wouldn't be hostile to her. But they are. But they were respectful. So she does her little tap dance, says the stuff she normally says, but she's asked by one of the students, can you define wokeness? Because this is her main thing. She brings up wokeness all the time. Woke this, woke that. You guys know the drill. Look at how bad she faceplants when asked to define something that is like the core of her politics. Watch this.
It's in our kids' schools. It's on college campuses. It is in the workforce. It is in the streets. It's when you go to the store. I mean, like, you can't do anything in peace without this wokeness being shoved down your throat wherever you go. So, do you have a question? Is there something funny?
I do.
Yeah, sure.
How do you define wokeness?
Wokeness is the destruction of normalcy
Wokeness is the destruction of normalcy. Normalcy is not a word. Bro, this is the core of your politics. This, like, oh, remember, what was that woman's name? Was it Bethany Mandel or something like that? She was being interviewed by Breonna Joy Gray. And Breonna asked her, like, can you define wokeness? And she wasn't saying it as a gotcha. She was actually trying to engage in the conversation in question. And the woman just totally shut down. Totally blanked. Just like, boom, eyes glaze over. Nothing's there. Can't do it. Not even close. And now you have the queen of anti-wokeness is asked to define it. And she says, wokeness is the destruction of, they're being nice in this, and they say normalcy. She said normalcy. And, come on, man. All right, so look, what's the reality here? At this point, all these people that are obsessed with wokeness, it's just like, anything that I personally don't like, which is sort of a lefty or liberal thing, right? Like, that's what it's become. Anything that's left of center that annoys me is now wokeness, which is why you've seen the mission creep. It used to be more relegated to social issues type stuff and stuff around race and gender. And then now it's become, you know, we've seen the arguments. Universal healthcare is woke. We just did the segment where the End Wokeness account was bitching and moaning about the minimum wage being increased in California. So now higher minimum wage is woke. Universal healthcare is woke. Is getting money out of politics woke too? Is that woke? Like, you're making it so everybody wants to sign up for wokeness now. It's just mission creep. Anything that's left of center that they don't like, they just say, hey, wokeness, bad. Now, in reality, how was it used? Well, there's two ways I look at it, wokeness. There's the positive interpretation and the negative interpretation. The positive interpretation of wokeness is being alert to injustice. Like, back in the day, they'd be like, stay woke. And that meant, like, you know, keep your eyes on the injustice. Try to improve things, make things better. That's the positive connotation. The negative connotation of wokeness is, and this is the way that many on the right used it for a long time, is like calling out people who use authoritarianism in service of what they view as social justice, right? So, like, censoring somebody who says something that's racist or sexist, saying, hey, for the good of everybody, let's censor them because the harm that that's doing outweighs the virtue of protecting free speech. That would be wokeness, right? That's the negative interpretation of wokeness. She can't even give that. She couldn't even say it's when lefties are authoritarianism because they want to defend what they think is social justice. She can't even give that. The destruction of normalcy? The destruction of normalcy. So then look, we're at the point now where, based on your definition, straightforward interpretation of your definition, well, you know, gay marriage was a diversion from what was normal at the time, from normalcy at the time, right? So would you say gay marriage is woke? It fits your goofy-ass definition that you gave right there. And again, what she means is anything that goes against my sensibilities, I will define as woke, and I will attack. It's just, I told you guys a while ago, we reached peak wokeness. Remember, you had Ron DeSantis running an entire presidential campaign on wokeness. Then they actually did some polling on it, and most people were like, what the fuck is wokeness? And dropped it immediately. I mean, like that, him and Vivek Ramaswamy running on, oh, I'm against wokeness, bro. And then as soon as they saw the polling numbers, that, like, nobody knows what the fuck you're talking about. You look like a dork. This isn't landing. They dropped it like hot potatoes. And then, so now we've gone past peak wokeness. Nobody knows what you're saying. Normies don't. Nobody cares what you're saying. And so now when asked to define it, this is the best she could do. Things that are a violation of normalcy. Wokeness is the destruction of normalcy. And but okay, by that definition, anything that is not status quo is woke. Anything that's not status quo is woke. But there's so much about the status quo that sucks, right? Like, endless war is the status quo. Does that mean being anti-war is woke? Like, oh, God. Oh, it's so embarrassing. How did this woman become a political figure? This is the saddest thing I've ever seen in my life. Oh, anyway, good luck with that, conservatives. Come get your intellectuals. All right, guys. So we've been having the conversation about how Congress is now very interested in banning TikTok. That's on the menu. You got a lot of big money interests lobbying for that to be the case. And we got into the specifics as to why that is. I mean, literally the most important part of that is Israel. It's all being framed as like, oh, China's stealing your data, and that's why we got to stop them, because we don't want China stealing your data, bro. Everybody already has stolen our data. I mean, Congress literally passed a law, and Trump signed a law that had like a 6 or 9% approval rating or something like that, that made it so any company can sell your data to a third party and they don't need your permission. We have the American government spying on us relentlessly. If China wanted to get our data, they could have already had it 17 different ways. Okay? So this has nothing to do with China. The real reason they wanted to crack down on TikTok is because it became a hotbed for pro-Palestine activism. And you had the ADL, Jonathan Greenblatt, and the Israel lobby. They did not like that. And they were very open about it. He talked about it on MSNBC. Like, we have a TikTok problem. We need to do something about it. And so, boom, you had the resurrection of the banning TikTok bill. Okay. Well, now we have another softer, perhaps equally insidious version of this. Look at this. Instagram update: limiting political content sparks outrage among pro-Palestinian activists. The default setting for an update to the app limits content likely to mention governments, elections, or social topics that affect a large group of people. An Instagram update automatically limiting the amount of political content that shows up in users' feeds has sparked a wave of discontent from social media users and activists, including pro-Palestine activists who accuse the platform of censorship. A setting for political content was added to the app, which is owned by Meta, apparently without notifying users of the change. That is really fucking nefarious right there. The setting is toggled to limit by default, though users can manually change this to don't limit. The change affects posts likely to mention governments, elections, or social topics that affect a large group of people and or society at large, according to a guidance note. It will also affect suggestions in Explore, Reels, feed recommendations, and suggested users, as well as Instagram sister app Threads, it added. So in other words, Threads and Instagram are kind of nuking political content with their maneuver here. Users accusing Instagram of active censorship took to X, formerly Twitter, to express outrage, with many surprised after noticing the newly imposed limitations on their feed. One user stated, "They want us to post and engage with images of mountains, holidays, beautiful portraits, flowers, and all. They think we have too much of Palestine, Congo, migrant sovereignty, indigenous movement, environmental justice, and racism-related content going around. Many activist movements use social media platforms, including Instagram, for disseminating information, organizing protests, and other forms of mobilization. Since the start of Israel's assault on the Gaza Strip following the Hamas-led attack on October 7th, social media posts by Palestinian journalists and citizens on the ground have become key sources of information as the Israeli government has banned international media from entering the Strip. Palestinians also use social media to call for help or get news about their loved ones amid frequent Israeli-imposed telecommunication blockouts on the besieged territory. In December, Human Rights Watch said in a report that Meta, which runs Instagram and Facebook, is systematically censoring content about Palestine on their social networks. So here's the thing, man. This is done on purpose. And this is why you're seeing this new wave of censorship. This is why you saw the revival of the bill to ban TikTok. This is why you see Instagram and Threads making this move. It is directly related to pro-Palestinian content. The narrative cannot be suppressed any longer, so they had to come up with new ways to try to suppress it, to try to suppress the truth and try to stick to the script and go with their narrative. And like I said, this is very subtle and very insidious. So they default change the settings to limit political stuff and you have to click out of it. Well, guess what? I'm sure they did the math. I'm sure they crunched the numbers. I'm sure they ran their calculations. And what they found out is that probably only 50% of people, I'm just making a number up there, but some percentage of the people will recognize, oh, this limited the political content. Let me find if I can click it back into existence. And some large chunk of people are just not even going to realize that's the case. So the end result here is you've effectively, perhaps cut in half or more, the spread of this sort of crucial information. It's all on purpose. It's all on purpose. Look, this should terrify all of you, man. It really should. And as somebody who has a political channel, of course, this scares the shit out of me too, because we've gone through portions of YouTube going absolutely insane, right? We've gone through stretches like that. Remember the first adpocalypse? That was terrifying. There's also been times YouTube has tweaked the algorithm and made it so, you know, shows like this really don't get that much play, despite having a decent number of subscribers and a decent number of views. There's been times where people who are subscribed to the show can't see the things in their feed for whatever reason. I think that it all comes down to they want to make sure, oh, we don't want to scare away the advertisers. We don't want to scare away the big brand names because they don't want to think, oh, I'm running my ads on controversial stuff. I think ultimately at the end of the day, it comes down to dollars and cents. It comes down to money. And they're trying to make as much money as possible. And if that means, hey, we're going to have to sacrifice political content, they will immediately sacrifice political content. But there's a colossal loss in that scenario. And in this instance, the loss is people not getting nearly as much information and facts about what's happening to Palestinians at a time which is a historic moment. I mean, this is going to be remembered in the history books. We are alive during an absolute atrocity. And to really bury your head in the sand. And it goes to show you, man, all this concern about all the misinformation and the disinformation. Stop and think about it. In a world that made sense, right? If the social media companies existed back during the days of Nazi Germany, wouldn't you think, hey, if they're going to censor anybody, it should probably be the Nazis and the Nazi supporters, right? Not the victims. In this instance, they're like, we'll allow the Israel stuff to flourish, but we got to crack down on the Palestinian stuff. To be fair, in this case, it's a little different. In this Instagram update, they just want to limit like all the political content. But like, we see this all over mainstream media, right? The Israeli perspective flourishes, but then the Palestinian perspective in Western outlets is like barely mentioned, barely allowed in the room. So, but to the extent that you're going to do any sort of censorship, I'm not in favor of censorship, but to the extent that you're going to do it, you would think that it's like, well, we definitely should censor the extremists, not the victims. But in this instance, it's like the victims having a voice that's leading to let's censor. That's crazy to me. That's crazy to me. But that's where we are. It's like we always say, if social media existed back during the lead up to the Iraq War and during the Iraq War, the people they would have censored would have been the ones saying, hey, this is bullshit. Saddam Hussein did not work with Osama bin Laden. Saddam Hussein did not do 9/11. Saddam Hussein doesn't have weapons of mass destruction. They would have been censoring those people, saying that's misinformation. When in reality, the misinformation was coming from George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and the U.S. government. It was lie on top of lie on top of lie. And that was the accepted narrative, the mainstream narrative. And this feels very similar, right? Let's nuke all of the political content on Instagram, hide all the political content. And the genesis of that is we don't want people seeing this Palestine stuff. And again, probably the core of it is they're afraid advertisers will flee if we allow this stuff to flourish. And so they're like, well, let's appease the advertisers and just ban all these, or let's try to suppress all of this stuff. It's really disgusting. So now you have to try extra hard to search for good information. Like, they're making it hard for you to stay educated and up to date on what's happening with our money and in our name if you live in the United States. So, shame on them, man. Shame on them. And geez, I got my fingers crossed just hoping that we don't go down this path and make it even worse on YouTube, because that's the last thing we need is further suppression of content like ours. Despite what you hear from the Biden administration, the economy is not doing great. Like, the thing that I look at time and time again are the numbers that come out on people living paycheck to paycheck, people who can't afford a $500, $1,000 emergency. Those numbers are always devastating when you look at those. Now, it's true that the stock market is doing well and the unemployment rate is low. But for the stock market doing well, that's more of a reflection of how the top 10% or maybe 20% of the country is doing. and the unemployment rate being low, yeah, that's good. But a lot of those jobs are like shitty gig economy jobs. And how many people are working two jobs or three jobs, or how many people are underemployed, right? Like those facts kind of leave out that angle to it, which is kind of misleading. So to me, it's like, you know, you see the 60 to 70% of Americans living paycheck to paycheck, some gargantuan number, can't afford a $500 emergency. Things are not as great as they're pretending that they are. Okay, let's just say that. Well, Judd Legum wrote a phenomenal piece here on his site, Popular Information, and it dives into really the core of the problem here. One of the persistent problems that people keep talking about is inflation, right? Like, oh, when I go to the grocery store, I'm paying way more than I used to, and I don't like that, and that's hurting my wallet or my pocketbook or whatever. He lays out how we got here. Look at this. Corporate profit bonanza. In the last 3 months of 2023, after-tax corporate profits reached an all-time high of $2.8 trillion. This is part of a long-term growth in corporate profits that began in the 1980s, picked up steam at the turn of the millennium, and exploded since 2020. So remember, there is inflation, and they argue, oh God, bro, we got to raise the price, bro, we got no choice, bro. Well, Judd Legum just told you, after-tax corporate profits are at an all-time high. It's not like they have these tiny profit margins and that's, there's inflation, we have to raise the prices to keep our tiny profit margin. All-time high corporate profits. Okay, let's continue. Look at the chart. Look at the chart. Corporate profits after tax. Look at this. 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, and then... So they say it really started with Reagan, but then massive uptick in the George W. Bush years, and then the crash with the Great Recession, and then boom, after the Great Recession, just total skyrocket job under a little bit under Obama, under Trump, and now under Biden. Look at this chart. This corporate profits chart is absurd. So here's what he says. Notably, the surge in corporate profits since 2020 has been fueled in part by expanding corporate profit margins. Last year, corporate profit margins, excluding the financial sector, were over 15%, a level not seen since the 1950s. This is because the increases in prices for goods and services have outpaced the increase in costs, both labor and non-labor, for corporations. According to an analysis from the Groundwork Collaborative, corporate profits drove 53% of inflation during the second and third quarters of 2023, and more than one-third since the start of the pandemic. Okay, do you understand that? Corporate profits drove 53% of inflation. That's something you didn't know. That's not, the thing you hear all the time. Oh my God, bro. Big government spending, bro. Leading to inflation, bro. Big government spending, bro. Big government spending is bad, bro. How many times have you heard this? You hear this all the time. That's not the problem here. He continues. In the 4 decades prior to the pandemic, corporate profits contributed to just 11% of price increases. Theoretically, this should not happen. Corporations should not be able to dramatically increase their profit margins by increasing prices because competitors should step in with lower prices and steal market share. So what's going on? Greg Ipp, who writes about economics for the Wall Street Journal, suggests that corporations are collectively taking advantage of consumer psychology. Supply shocks related to the pandemic created widespread cost increases that consumers accepted. Although those supply shocks have dissipated, many businesses have maintained higher prices anyway. In other words, this isn't about the pandemic. This isn't about the supply chain. Now they're just keeping prices high because they feel like they can. Quote, if people are paying $3 for a dozen eggs last week, they'll pay $3 this week. And firms take advantage of that. Yale University economist Mike Sinkinson explained, this kind of informal collusion works best in concentrated industries. The Groundwork Collective highlights the diaper industry, where Procter & Gamble & Co. and Kimberly-Clark Corp. control 70% of the domestic market. So this is an oligopoly, is what we're looking at. Diaper prices have increased by more than 30%, from $16.50 per package to nearly $21. This was initially driven by an increase in the price of wood pulp, a key input for diapers, but also paper towels and toilet paper. But since January 2023, prices for wood pulp have declined by 25%. But P&G and Kimberly-Clark are not reducing diaper prices. Instead, they are bragging to investors about their massive profits. In July 2023, P&G predicted $800 million in windfall profits because of declining input costs. Wow. This is why you need a windfall profits tax. In October 2023, Kimberly-Clark acknowledged that its input costs were coming down, but said that its products were still priced appropriately at that higher rate. Similar dynamics are playing out in many other industries, including new and used cars, groceries, and housing. So he continues here, how corporations are using their windfall. It's possible for corporate profits to be used productively to fuel innovation and growth, but that doesn't appear to be happening. Economist Christian Weller notes that corporations are using their record profits mainly to pay dividends to their shareholders and build up their stockpiles of cash. Between December 2019 and December 2023, non-financial corporations used almost half of their pre-tax profits to pay dividends to investors. That is the highest share of corporate profits devoted to dividends since the 1950s. The same group of corporations now has $7.2 trillion in cash, up from $6.1 trillion in 2019, adjusted for inflation. Meanwhile, capital expenditures, which is a key way corporations invest in the future, are at historic lows relative to profit. In layman's terms, they're just price gouging the shit out of you. In light of these record corporate profits, the government has a few choices. It could choose to raise corporate tax rates and use the funds to help people in need, such as children in poverty. In March, Biden released a proposal that would raise the corporate tax rate from 21 to 28%. Biden's proposal also includes raising the minimum tax for corporations with $1 billion in profits or more from 15 to 21%. The government could also choose to maintain the current corporate tax rate of 21%, which was established by the Trump administration in 2017 in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Trump wants voters to believe that if he is reelected, he will not prioritize corporate tax cuts. In January, Bloomberg reported that Trump plans to keep corporate tax levels unchanged and appeal to working and middle-class voters. What a sentence that is. Stephen Moore, an economic advisor to Trump, told the Washington Post that Trump said that he really wants to focus more on small businesses and the corporation, that he's fine with the corporate rate where it is. The government could also choose to cut the corporate tax rate even further and facilitate even larger corporate profits. Trump has expressed interest in lower corporate tax rates, perhaps as low as 15%. And then you say Project 2025, that's, you know, part of their whole spiel. So, look, what's the takeaway here? Who's to blame for the inflation? The corporations. What we're seeing here is mostly what's called greedflation, which is just, hey, we took advantage of the mass psychology of the population and the news hyping up the idea that there is inflation. We raised prices across the board, even for things that weren't actually impacted by inflation. We raised the prices because we felt like we could and we can get away with it. And then now, it's not like the raw goods that go into making a product. It's not like those prices are still high. They've come back down, but we're still charging you what we were charging before. We're still charging you at that higher rate, at that higher number. So in other words, the inflation is greedflation. And what's it going towards? Corporate profits. And it's not like they need the money, they have small margins, what are they going to do? That's not the case. It's not like they take the funds and they reinvest it in the company or look out for the workers. No. It's padding the bottom line. It's going to pay dividends. Look, I want to show you the chart one more time. Look at that chart. That's not normal. That's not okay. We need a windfall profits tax. You got to put these motherfuckers in line, man. They'll get away with whatever the fuck they think they can get away with. And if that means basically robbing the American people blind, then they're going to rob the American people blind. But this is what happens when you get a government that's basically bought and owned by the corporations, is that they're the real bosses, and that's how they keep getting away with this. So really unacceptable stuff, but very informative article here from Judd Legum. So just remember, it's everybody else who would be the conspiracy theorist. If they say, oh my God, inflation is because of the big government spending, or even at this point, even saying if inflation is due to the supply chain. No, the bulk of the problem is just the greed of the corporations. And this is a fixable problem, but you need the will to do it. You need to actually follow through. And so just understand, this is what's actually going on. All right, guys, it's time to talk about my favorite centrist. Look, I'm an open-minded guy. I like hearing all sorts of different perspectives. One of my favorite people to listen to is Stephen A. Smith. He's just amazing at delivering his commentary. You hang on every word. You love it. Even if you disagree with him completely, you're like, oh man, this is really interesting. He's so charismatic. I love this. So anyway, he went on CNN. He's doing a lot more political stuff in his own podcast now, so he's more comfortable going on all the news outlets and, you know, he'll do an interview about whatever. So he's going to be asked about that clip of Hillary Clinton where Hillary Clinton basically said when she was on Jimmy Fallon's show, asked about, hey, what do you say to people who are struggling about Biden versus Trump, et cetera? She's like, get over yourself. This isn't a hard choice. Get over yourself. Very smug, very condescending, very finger wagging, like shaming people, not really providing an argument or anything like that. Just like an entitled brat type attitude. So they asked Stephen A. about this. And like I said, look, Stephen A., he doesn't have my politics. I don't have his politics, right? I'm on the left. He's a centrist. He's very open about that fact. But I do love how he answers this question. Watch this.
I don't think it was a very wise statement on her part. How did that work out for her in 2016? I think that's something that we have to recognize. Yes, she won the popular vote, but at the end of the day, she wasn't the president of the United States. It was him. You can look at her not campaigning in Wisconsin in the last days, not campaigning in Pennsylvania in the last days. You can look at some of the stuff that they were saying about her that sort of distracted things from where it should have been in terms of Comey and his report from the FBI. You can bring up a whole bunch of things, but at the end of the day, the last thing you need to do is to do anything that could agitate a potential voter in this particular election.
What do you make about the actual argument that she's making? I mean, she's basically saying two old people, yes.
Yes.
But they're substantively different. I mean, Trump absolutely. Has 91 well, counts against him.
Well, and listen. If you're nobody's not brought that up more than me. For, yeah. You know, four indictments, 91 counts, impeached twice. I'm not voting for him. I've said that to a lot of people. I've said that to you. But at the end of the day, what I'm saying is that at some point in time, you got to take into account what the voters thinking about. The voters, a lot of them out there, tens of millions of them out there, by the way, don't care what he's going through right now. They don't care about his guilt or innocence, his perceived guilt or innocence. They don't care about the 91 counts. They're thinking about their lives. And a lot of times we see politicians taking the positions that they're taking. And while we can respect their candor and their honesty, they do seem a bit detached at times from what the voters are actually feeling and what the voters are actually thinking. Nobody wants to hear that from Hillary Rodham Clinton at this particular moment in time, because especially if you're Joe Biden, what are you really, really worried about right now? You're worried about folks coming to the polls. You're worried about them showing up to the polls to vote for you. You're not worried even about them voting for Trump. You're worried about them not showing up to vote for you. That doesn't exactly encourage them to get up out of their seats.
God damn, son. Rest in peace, Hillary. Jesus Christ. Wow. He's exactly right. He's exactly right. Yeah, they set it up like it's this false dichotomy. Like, oh my God, these people might go vote for Trump instead. No, that's not what you have to worry about, numbnuts. What you have to worry about is staying home or voting for Jill Stein or Cornel West, right? Like, that's what you need to think about. And that attitude of like, please shut up and get over yourself. It's like, she literally said, get over yourself. Well, that's not going to address their concerns. And something Stephen A. didn't bring up, but from my perspective is probably the most important thing, is who are these people really who are making the most noise about Biden right now, who have organized the uncommitted campaign in a bunch of the different states that allow voting uncommitted in the primary? These are all people who are screaming about the same issue. Gaza. The United States is arming and funding Israel as they carry out an ethnic cleansing and a genocide in Gaza. Over 40,000 Palestinians dead. Over 15,000 of them are children. Do you really think your smug-ass attitude is going to override people's concerns about our money arming and funding a genocide? You really think that the point that Hillary Clinton made, people are going to look at that and go, you know what? She's right. I no longer care about the lives of Palestinian babies being carpet bombed. Please. That's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. And they really need to take Hillary Clinton and just make sure she's not in front of a single freaking camera between now and the election, because that is the worst. It's like an anti-surrogate for Biden. There's like surrogates who go out there to try to get people to vote for Biden. Then there's the anti-surrogate. Every time she talks, Biden loses a couple more voters, right? Like that's the vibe you get from it. And Stephen A's right. She's the last person on earth who can make the arguments that she's making. She hasn't learned anything at all from 2016. That's what this shows. And by the way, her saying get over it or get over yourself is rich, because every time she's in front of a camera, she's whining and bitching and moaning about losing in 2016 and blaming 78 things that are not Hillary Rodham Clinton. So last person who can make that argument. And again, remember, Stephen A. and I don't share a political philosophy. He's a centrist. I'm a lefty. But the core of the criticism here against Hillary, which is like, Hey, you're not helping. You're not helping. That's undeniably true. And the sense you get from his argument is, you're going to have to at least pretend to give a shit about what your voters want. Guys, this is the massive difference between Republican politicians and Democratic politicians. Republican politicians, honestly, are terrified of their base. And they're often bending over backwards, trying to accommodate their base, trying to say the things that their base wants to hear. Honestly, it's so much that it's to a fault. Because then you get the craziest, most psycho extremist motherfucker on the far right, and you have a lot of mainstream Republican politicians who are sort of like lending credence to their ideas, right? That's the right. On the Democratic side, they despise their base. They hate their base. Democratic politicians aren't scared of their base. They're not terrified of their base. They're not constantly bending over backwards to do what their base wants. Democratic Party politics is built on despising the left-wing base and constantly and repeatedly going further and further right and trying to get the moderate voters, the Nikki Haley types, the anti-Trump Republicans, the suburban people. Like, that's what it comes down to. So in other words, the base, it's just, they just like grandfather in, like, fuck you, you're going to vote for us anyway. We're not even going to pay any attention to you. And then they get mad when the polls come out and it's like, hey, your base is not happy. You need to do something to serve them. It's get over yourself. You want to dig your hole deeper? By all means, go right ahead. You're never going to talk your way out of the fact that the main concern of these people is we are arming and funding a genocide and Joe Biden is aiding and abetting it. Your best way out of this is to immediately get him to change course. Cut off the money. Cut off the weapons, condemn Israel at the UN, have him make a phone call, say, sorry, but this is done. This is over with. Sanction top Israeli officials. If you want a real fundamental change in the number of young people, the number of Arab Americans and young Americans, Arab Americans and Muslim Americans that support Biden, that's what you would do. Instead, they have scorn and derision, adding to their long track record of scorn and derision. So, spot on. Stephen A. absolutely obliterated her. Fun to see. All right, y'all. So some big news came out the other day that I wanted to share with you. In Florida, in the upcoming election, they're going to have a direct ballot initiative, a direct vote on both abortion rights and legal weed. So the Associated Press says Florida voters will decide whether to protect abortion rights and legalize pot in November. The Florida Supreme Court issued rulings Monday allowing the state's voters to decide whether to protect abortion rights and legalize recreational use of marijuana, rejecting the state attorney general's argument that the measure should be kept off the November ballot. The court was not ruling on the merits of the measures, but only whether they meet the requirements for clarity and don't violate the state constitution's mandate that they only cover one subject. The court's ruling came the same day it upheld the state's ban on most abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. State lawmakers had tightened the ban to 6 weeks while the issue was still in court. Monday's ruling, therefore, likely paves the way for the six-week ban to go into effect. So, a couple different issues here jumbled up into one story, but the court basically said, yeah, it is constitutional in the state of Florida. You want the 15-week abortion ban, and it's passed by the legislature. Okay, you get the 15-week abortion ban. So, on that one, that's a very conservative ruling. But what they say is, for the direct ballot initiative, we're allowing on the vote about legalizing recreational marijuana, and we're allowing on the vote of letting the people decide whether or not to basically overturn that restrictive abortion law and protect the right to choose. So really, really interesting. Here's why this is actually a giant deal. This is a giant deal because Florida at this late date is not really considered a swing state anymore. It's not. It's really considered like a relatively safe red state. Republicans have been winning it for quite a while now. And I think that's the sort of like universally accepted, right? Well, because of these two direct ballot initiatives that are going on for November. Now, I mean, I don't know if I'd go as far as to say it's definitely a swing state, but I will go as far as to say it's certainly more of a swing state than it's been in the past two or three elections. It's certainly more on the table than it's been in the recent past. So will it be competitive? I don't know. I'm a little skeptical on that front. But certainly these direct ballot initiatives will get more people to the polls by their very nature because of the issues that they're on and make it way more possible that Biden could take the state over Trump just because these two direct votes are on the ballot. Now, it's very possible people might still vote for that and then leave it blank, right? I still think you're looking at a Trump plus five type state, right? But in theory, it makes it much more competitive than it would have been otherwise. Now, here's the other thing. I mean, look, I'll go out on a limb here. I'll make the prediction right now. So my guess is, and this isn't particularly like controversial, right? But I think they're going to vote in favor of the right to choose. And I think it's going to be kind of comfy. I think it's going to be pretty comfy margin. I think they're going to vote for legalizing recreational marijuana. Although I will say, I think it's going to be a little bit, it's not going to be as overwhelming as the vote will be for the right to choose. So it'll still win, but it'll be by smaller margin than the right to choose. But then I also think it's still going to be Trump winning, maybe with like 54% of the vote, something like that. So you're going to see like, yeah, we're pro-abortion. Yeah, we're pro-weed. And also we support Trump. And the reason I make this prediction, it's a loose prediction, but a prediction nonetheless, is that I believe it was in 2020 where they had a direct ballot initiative on raising the minimum wage. And it passed overwhelmingly. It got like 60% of the vote, right? And I don't know, in Florida, it might be you need 60% in order to get the thing passed. I don't remember. I'm going to have to read more about that. But so it passed with 60% and Trump won the state. And that was the go-to example of like, there's a very big disconnect between when you give people the ability to vote on specific issues, I think they are overwhelmingly reasonable. Like 80% of the time, the direct ballot votes go the way I want them to go. So it's higher minimum wage, legal weed, right to choose. Every red state that's voted on the right to choose always chooses to be pro-abortion and by decent margins. Every time you give people a direct vote and it's not like totally clouded by propaganda that confuses you about which way is the proper way to vote, the better side usually wins. But then they end up sometimes doing that while also voting for candidates who could not oppose what you believe any more than they do. Right. And I think that's probably what's going to happen this time around. Also, I think Trump will win the state, but you'll also get the right to choose and you'll also get legal marijuana. So anyway, we'll see. But this is certainly a big deal. I want a lot more of this, man. I want a lot more of the direct votes. I just feel like it's a better way to run the government. We have so much corruption, so much influence of big money. Giving a vote directly to the people, I love that. I love that. Whether it's at the state level, I would like to see it at the federal level, almost like a whole new branch of government where it's the people's voice and they can override everybody type stuff. We'd be so much more advanced if that was the case. It's literally a way to circumvent corruption too. Sometimes you have, big money lobbying groups come in and they spend a lot of money on ads to try to confuse you about the whatever the vote is. We could have some way of regulating that, right? But to give people the direct vote, it's just so much better than what we have at the federal level that I would really welcome this change. So big news, very, very positive stuff. And I think the results will be pretty solid. All right, guys, that's the show, y'all. I love y'all very much as always. Everybody do me a favor, please subscribe to the channel. Helps out massively, costs you nothing at all. Trying to get to 10 million subs. We got a while to go, but as I always say, we got to build it one at a time. So thank you. If you are indeed subbing, click that bell icon so you get a notification every time a video drops. Anytime you leave a comment or a like, that certainly helps in the algorithm, helps push the video out a whole bunch more. Thank you so much to everybody who supports the show on Patreon or tips with the thanks button on YouTube. You know I love you guys. You can always sign up for Crystal Kyle and Friends on Substack as well. That link is below. This week we have on Anna Kasparian, and I'm really looking forward to that. Should be a fun conversation. All right, guys. I will see all of you tomorrow for Crystal Kyle and Friends with Anna. And that's all we got. I'll talk to you later. Peace.